It's a beautiful day for a ball game. For a ball game today.
All right.
The fans are out.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And every time I hear that the beginning of that song, Dan, I think of Roy Leonard's baseball game that he used to play. And as soon as you heard that, you had to call in. First person in would pick numbers, and there would be different carts with plays on the, you know, from the games. And if you scored a run, you won tickets to see the Cubs. And he would do it. It's play ball. It's called play ball. It was Roy Leonard's play ball. And every time I hear that song, I always think, oh, let's get to the phone and call immediately and trying to get in. So anyway, the reason why Dan played that is because we're about to talk baseball, Cubs specifically. Well, baseball in general and also Cubs. By the way, it's Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to have some bunch of food topics we're going to talk about later on, including food holidays that you can celebrate this year and much more. But yes, like I said, we're going to talk about baseball here. George Castle is my guest. He's written several books about baseball, the latest being the 1969 Cubs Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. He co-wrote that book with Fergie Jenkins. He's a historian, and he also writes for the Chicago Baseball Museum. We'll find out all about that, all about the book, and all about baseball writing in general as we welcome George to the show. George, welcome to the show.
Nick, do you know that that song is a soundtrack of my youth? You had that in your youth, too, because that always opened the Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau broadcast.
Yeah.
That really, you know, that's childhood has not ended when you hear that song. And number two, I'll say you don't sound like Franklin McCormick, because even earlier than that, if I, on the odd time that I might wake up during the middle of the night, I would hear Franklin McCormick,
right,
2-3 in the morning when he wasn't reading poetry, when he wasn't hiccuping through a 5 a.m. newscast. He'd give the Peoria livestock reports and ended with, "and four poor little old sheep."
Yeah. Oh, Franklin McCormick. Lots of history with this station, George. Lots of it.
More history than any other station, I think, in the country.
Yeah, I agree. So I just give you a little background on me really quickly, George. I grew up 7 blocks away from Wrigley Field on Addison. And I would go to the games constantly. And I know that we have that in common. You would go to Comiskey and you would go to Wrigley pretty regularly. When did your love of baseball begin?
Probably in the late 1960s, when I was freed from Hebrew school after school, couldn't watch the end of the Cubs game because I had to learn my Hebrew, B'nai Jacob, near Devon and Western.
Mm.
But it really was that 1969 season where I kind of felt liberated. The Cubs threw off the shackles of being in the second division for more than 20 years. They had a team with 4 Hall of Famers, Ron Santo, Ernie Banks, Billy Williams, and my co-author Fergie Jenkins.
Yeah.
And we recounted not only the play-by-play of the season, but also the whole cultural landscape of baseball at the time and how that transformed the Cub franchise into what we see now, where you pack the ballpark on a Wednesday afternoon on a beautiful summer day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing growing up in that neighborhood during the 70s when I grew up there, and I was 4 when the 1969 Cubs campaign happened, so I don't remember much. I do vaguely remember how excited my father was about it, but in that, just living in that neighborhood throughout, I lived there from 65 when I was born to 83. So right before 84, we moved.
Right before it became regentrified.
Yeah,
now, I will
exactly
tell you this.
Right, yeah.
I will tell you this. The neighborhood was so sketchy in the mid-70s that I took my Junker 65 Buick Special, parked it on Fremont 3 hours before a Sunday game. Nobody ever bothered the car, and he could always get a space. Now everything is legislated,
yeah.
Parking restrictions. You'll get towed if you park around there for a night game. It's very corporatized. Then it was very genteel. The trade-off was you had mostly losing teams.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you're right. The neighborhood was really sketchy. Having grown up there, I can attest to that. And it was easy to get in. You can get into Wrigley Field for any game at any time. And And so, yeah. So now, when you started to go to Wrigley, you would pay like what, like a buck or something to get into.
Here are the ticket prices, Nick. 1971, I went to the first of 41 straight Cubs openers. I paid $1.75. Got there at 9:30 a.m. for a 1:30 game. Froze my rear end off. I forgot to bring my gloves, and I couldn't keep score. I could just write in Brock on the scorecard, and then I had to give up. And Fergie Jenkins pitched against Bob Gibson. Billy Williams hit a walk-off homer off Gibson in the 10th inning. 1 hour and 59 minutes.
Wow. At least you weren't out there very long in the cold. Well, you got there at 9:30, so you were out there in the cold. But, yeah, that's unheard of.
Well, you had to get there. You had to, you know, for crowded games, for Sunday doubleheaders, if you wanted your seat,
yeah,
you had to wait in line. Now, for the 1978 opener, there were 4,000 people waiting in line for the bleachers at 8 a.m. when they opened the gates. So I had a tactic where there was confusion at the front of the line, pushing and shoving. So I moved from the middle of the line into the mob scene, sneaked in through the turnstile in the confusion, and claimed my typical right field bleacher seat.
Well, there you go.
Cutting in line, that's another Chicago tradition.
Yeah, it is. You're right. Now, what about some of your memories of Comiskey, going to the old Comiskey?
You could get high from secondhand smoke there. on nights where it wasn't disco demolition, it had a pungent odor. It was smoky and enclosed, that old ballpark, and there were really no such things as bleachers. There were all these kind of broken up old seats in the right field upper deck, and it was a long L trip down. Before I had a car, it was a long L trip, and early on, you took what was then the Jackson Park L, and it was a little bit of a nervous walk past the old Taylor Homes down 35th Street to the ballpark. Yeah. Otherwise, you had to transfer downtown to what was then the brand-new Dan Ryan L.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. Now, I went to an opening day, 1974, Sox versus Angels, Nolan Ryan pitching. It was during the streaking fad, and a naked man jumped on the field in the left field corner, and he wasn't out there very long before the gendarmes dragged him off, and it was so cold that, as Mike Royko used to write then, these streakers had to worry about an appendage falling off.
Oh, streaking.
Frostbite.
Only in the 70s would streaking be a thing. Crazy.
Yeah, and there were people disrobing. There were people flashing all over Comiskey Park that day. And Sox lost, of course. And I was out of town for the Southside Hitmen of 77. I was interning at a newspaper in Decatur. I would only be able to get home enough times to see Cubs games on the weekend or a few games in St. Louis. But missed that with Steve Stone and Richie Zisk and Oscar Gamble. But some of the worst uniforms in history, those black and white softball uniforms that Bill Veeck put in.
So you started writing about baseball at a pretty young age and covering baseball at a pretty young age. Talk about your first writing gigs covering baseball.
Well, my first gig, I was 20 years old, worked as a copy boy at the Tribune and contributed to then TV radio critic Gary Deeb's columns. And then about 1980, missed out on the Tribune gig. You know, you screw things up when you're young. You don't make good decisions. I ended up on the Lerner newspapers, the old Lerner newspapers, which covered the Lerner Times, had covered your old school at Luther North.
Oh, they did?
I did the Luther North coverage, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow, okay.
The Northwest side.
Wow.
And so I got my credential through Lerner, and I remember my first opening day with the credential, the crowd booed Bruce Sutter because he had just won a $700,000 arbitration award where the Cubs had offered $350,000. So the salaries were pretty quaint by today's standards.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what were some of the more memorable things that you covered on the beat?
I would say, well, I wasn't out there for the 2016 World Series, but certainly the Bartman game, I had to change my lead. I said that the Cubs had thrown off all the shackles of their bad bad luck, and Mark Pryor was channeling lightning through his arm. And I had to throw out that league and lead and write it over again. And I was going to use it for the next night because the Cubs still had Game 7.
Yeah.
Well, when I looked for the lead in the middle of Game 7, the Cubs were still tied. Lead had disappeared, so the fate was just not there.
Yeah, boy, that was rough. That was a rough series right there. Man, oh man.
I would say that the Cubs. Jack Berkowitz used to say he wouldn't criticize Cubs management because WGN was getting the TV and radio rights for under market rate. Mm. So Brickhouse criticized management, and he knew the true incompetency of the Wrigley family regime. He'd be killing his own golden goose.
Yeah.
Because even in a losing season, WGN would make tremendous amounts of money over those gasoline and beer ads.
Yeah.
You know, old style, fully Croyson from God's country.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, so it's so many memories covering that. And so I want to talk about your books. We're going to take a break here in a minute. I want to talk about your books, starting with I Remember Harry Carey. And, of course, we're going to talk about the 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten, which you co-wrote with Fergie Jenkins. And I also want to talk about the Chicago Baseball Museum. By the way, people can check out the website. It's 1969cubs.com. And that's the numbers 1969, 1969cubs.com, and also ChicagoBaseballMuseum.org for more information. And we have links on
Facebook. I want to say www.1969cubs.com to order a copy of the 1969 book.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone number also being 844-FERGIE-1.
Oh, 844-FERGIE-1. That's easy to remember.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, George.
It should have been 31, but they couldn't get it, you know.
Okay.
And he ended up having his number retired with Maddox because the Cubs did not take Fergie's number out of circulation and gave it to Greg Maddox.
Yes. That's right. I totally forgot about that. All right, George, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, George Castle is with us. He is the author of several books about baseball. The latest is the 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten, which he co-wrote with Fergie Jenkins, and I'm sure he's got great stories about that and more. We'll talk about it after the news here on 720 WGN.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it. The Cubs are on their way. Hey, hey, the Cubs are gonna hit today. They're gonna pitch today. They're gonna
There you go. More Cubs. Yes. You know, in this kind of, you know, very wintry, cold weather, and we've got some Arctic blasts coming through the city over the weekend, it's nice to think about baseball. Just to think about summer and some baseball and some really cool stuff happening either at Wrigley or at Guaranteed Rate. Or Wrigley at Guaranteed Rate. So George Castle is with us. By the way, it's Allstate Studios here, Skyline Studio. We're live on WGN. Nick DiGilio here, and George Castle is an author who's written several books about baseball. The latest being the 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. He co-wrote it with Fergie Jenkins. And let's welcome George back to the show. George, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick. And it's more than several of the 1969 Cubs is actually book number 17. And just a few minutes ago, you had mentioned my first book, I Remember Harry Carey.
Yes.
Back in 1998. That was the first book after Harry passed. And let me tell you, I had to keep that PG because the R and X rated stories about Harry I had to keep out.
Well, you know, so did you start writing that book before or after Harry's death?
No, I actually, somebody else, you talk about how an author's career is launched. There was another writer at the Times of Northwest Indiana for whom I was covering the Cubs at the time, and he couldn't do the book, but realized I was at the ballpark all the time, so he lateraled the project over to me, and I talked to all these people who were involved in Harry's life. Excuse me. And the one person who didn't want to talk about Harry was Tony La Russa, who he felt Harry had jumped him as a young White Sox manager. After Harry's death, Tony La Russa was hard pressed to say anything nice about Harry.
Wow, wow. So so you had to keep it PG. But we all had our ideas about the kind of lifestyle that Harry had. I mean, he didn't really hide that very well.
No, you know, he died at age 84, and he literally packed 2 to 3 lifetimes
yeah.
in those 84 years, and he literally died standing on his feet. He collapsed in a Palm Springs restaurant while he was waiting for a table with Dutchie. And the interesting thing is the man never slept. And the whole narrative of Harry just going 36, 40 hours without sleep, you know, doing his night spots on the road, it's just unbelievable. I don't know how he did it.
Yeah, some of the stories that I've heard, and, you know, and I think it was a quote that Jack Brickhouse had, because Jack Brickhouse and Harry would go out and carouse pretty frequently.
I don't think Jack was in Harry's category still. Jack could down a few, but in terms of closing down everything, literally go all night, Harry was in a class by himself.
Yeah, great. It was such a character, and it was so much fun to listen to you know, to him and Steve Stone calling the games, and also, you know, when Harry and Jimmy Pearsall were doing the TV calls for the White Sox, that was classic stuff on O'Brien Channel.
I've got some audio tape of that from the old Channel 44.
Yeah.
And there is so much politically incorrect stuff that they could not practice today,
right,
between Harry and Jimmy.
Yeah, and I'm not a Sox fan at all, but I would watch those games almost exclusively because of those two guys, because they made it so entertaining. The calls were so funny and so outrageous that I would watch those games, being a hardcore Cubs fan and not a Sox fan.
Nick, I called that guerrilla theater of the air.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it was, and it was perfect for Bill Veeck's regime with the White Sox, of course. Jerry Reinsdorf wanted to clean things up when he took over ownership, and Harry and Jimmy were pushed out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was a special time, though, back then, for those guys. Well, all right, so we've talked about some of your baseball coverage in the past, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about your books, but let's get to the 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. How did you get involved with Fergie Jenkins to write the book?
Well, I've known Fergie for 35 years. I got particularly close to him when he had 2 years as Cubs pitching coach in 1995 and 96. And the oddball thing about that is two 1969 Cubs pitchers were back-to-back pitching coaches, because when Fergie was fired, he was succeeded by Phil Regan, the number one reliever for 1969 as pitching coach for the next 2 years. So that was really an experience. And I once asked Phil Regan if he did throw the spitter, and his answer was, I don't talk off the record. However, Billy Williams showed me one day how Regan transferred the Vaseline from somewhere in his uniform to the ball. It was like a third base coach giving signs the way you were touching different parts of the uniform.
Wow, that's interesting. Oh boy, back in the day, that's amazing. So Fergie, you did the idea to write. I mean, it's the 50th anniversary. Obviously, it's the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. It was actually his idea, and he had known me. He had read my books. We had stayed in touch. I did a syndicated radio show called Diamond Gems. There was quite a bit of an old WGN tape that was lost, stolen, and strayed that I put on there. And he contributed to the show. But last year, I should say, 2017, he actually came to me and said, do you want to do a book on the 69 Cubs? I said, let's go. Now, I will say this, that you have to have a Hall of Famer, the ace pitcher of 69, like Fergie, being involved in that, because the 69 story has been told many times in books, starting with a Rick Talley book in 1989,
right,
on the 20th anniversary. But And also, you have to approach it from a different manner, because, again, you've got 2016 coming in there, and the long-time yearning for a championship has been satisfied.
Right.
But what we realized was that the 69 Cubs had won for losing. They didn't win the pennant. The Mets pulled off a once-in-a-lifetime stretch run, 37-11 down the stretch.
Yeah.
But those players cemented themselves in an everlasting manner in the love of the fans. And because those players lived in Chicago year round, you'd bump into a Cub in the off season. They had a basketball team that used to go around and play in high school gyms.
Yeah.
So they were close to the community, and they lived in middle class homes. They didn't live in exclusive high rises in River North like the players do now.
Yeah. You know, I had the absolute unbelievable honor of getting to know Ron Santo when he was a broadcaster here at WGN.
Sure.
And he was just an incredible guy and told great stories off the air. And I'm sure that there are a lot of amazing stories. So let's talk about the season of 1969. Remind everybody, you know, pretty much how it began, how it started, and we all know pretty much how it ends. But there were a lot of incredible ups and downs throughout that season. Talk about the beginning of the 1969 Cubs season.
Well, it was the most memorable opening day in history. Willie Smith hit a pinch hit two-run homer to power the Cubs from behind in the 11th inning off of Barry Lurch of the Phillies. However, Fergie himself set up that dramatic event because he refused to tell Leo Durocher he was tired going in the ninth inning and gave up a three-run game-tying homer to Don Money. Mm. So if Fergie had said he was tired, you would have had that dramatic beginning.
Wow. Well, and it really must be special to have this book because you got a guy who was there firsthand. So you're getting firsthand stories, and this is the only book that really has that.
Yeah, I mean, the fans and Fergie and all the players were so close that Fergie let several bleacher bums stay in his hotel room in St. Louis because they didn't have $5 with them for a place to flop for the night. Yeah. And Fergie would go in to Ray's Bleachers, which is now Murphy's Bleachers, mm-hmm. and the night before his starts, they would do a celebratory toast. When would you have the ace pitcher hang around with fans the night before a start? And there was another story where Fergie and Ernie Banks were invited to a cancer charities softball game at Thelen Stadium. Fergie was pitching the next day against the Mets.
Oh, my God.
He goes and pitches two innings of 16-inch softball, pitches well in this charities game, then gets lit up by the Mets the next day. If the player did that today, there would be hell to pay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's unheard of. That's just, I mean, it was such a different time then. It really was. So the ups and downs of the 69 Cubs, tell everybody a little bit about how the season went.
Well, the Cubs got off to a 36-16 start, eight games in front in June. Everybody, the whole town went nuts. Cub power, emblems and stickers and, you know, were going throughout the city. The White Sox became irrelevant at the same time. And everybody thought this was finally going to be the year where the Cubs are going to win it all. You know, Ernie Banks was by far the most popular Cub. He was zeroing in on his 500th homer. Whenever he would hit a home run, Jack Berghaus would yell, "You wonderful old man, you." He's 38 years old. It's interesting because this is 16 years after Ernie Banks had first integrated the Cubs. Mm. And here he is, the most beloved team elder, and people just going absolutely nuts over Ernie. Unfortunately, these were players. It was a worse situation where Leo Durocher was starting to get senile as a manager. He wanted to win in the worst way. Did not trust anybody but his star players, and players like Ron Santo, Billy Williams. They played 160 to 162 games a year.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your relationship to Ron Santo.
Yeah.
He has raised, I don't know, he raised in his life how many tens of millions of dollars for diabetes research.
Absolutely.
But in 1969, it was not well known that he was suffering from type 1 diabetes, and he did not know during the course of a game. He had no glucometer and no kind of way to test his blood sugar.
Right, amazing.
He was just guessing. Could you imagine him playing all those day games and having a Hall of Fame career without knowing his blood sugar?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It really is. It really is. And, you know, you talk about how he raised so much money. You know, the annual Ron Santo walk, you know, I've done it many, many, many times. And when Ron was still alive, he would go to every site. He would make sure that he went to every single park where the walks were going to happen. And I mean, this was when he was ill, when he was, you know, he was traveling around in a motorized cart and everything. And, he was just an unbelievable guy, and he never complained. He never, you know, he did his job when he was on the field or in the broadcast booth. And, you know, you would never know that he was ill or anything like that. He was an amazing man, and he was really a really good guy.
Well, Nick, how many games in his career, again, in that heat at Wrigley Field, did he not feel well?
Yeah.
And he continued to play because obviously he was having diabetic symptoms and he could only react to the symptoms.
Right.
And there was one day where he started seeing three baseballs. He was having a severe diabetic reaction. The bases were loaded. The Cubs were down by one run. He swung at the middle baseball, hit a grand slam homer, and the base runner in front of him, Dick Nen, he was praying that he would run faster so Ron could get back to the dugout to take a quick swig of Coke or a candy bar to get that sugar fix.
Yeah, man, oh, man, incredible.
Hold
on for one second. We have to take a commercial break, okay?
Sure, no
problem. Hang on a second. George Castle is with us, and we've got more stories. The latest book is called The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. George Castle is the co-writer, along with the great Fergie Jenkins. We'll talk more about that and more baseball, and the Chicago Baseball Museum online. We'll definitely mention that as well. But we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, and that's 312-981-7200. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some food stories, including food holidays that you can celebrate this year and a bunch of other food-related stories. We love to talk about food on the show. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. My guest right now. We're talking baseball, as you can tell from the music that we've been playing, coming back here from break. George Castle is a writer of 17 books, the latest is called The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten. He co-wrote it with Fergie Jenkins, and if you can check out the 1969cubs.com, or you can call 844-FERGIE-1 to order your book. Let's welcome George back. George, welcome back.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring up a point, Nick, talking about Ron Santo's diabetes. We touched on this a couple of minutes ago. Billy Williams had a streak of 1,117 consecutive games, so he played 162 games. Santo played 160 in 1969, missed two games due to a knee injury. Don Kessinger wanted to play every game, didn't want to come out of the lineup, and he was tall and lanky, didn't have very much meat on his bones. And Randy Hundley, even more so, set the record for 160 games caught in 1968.
Jeez.
And when he had a ear infection, when he came back to the ballpark coming from the hospital, DeRocher asked, can he come back in the lineup? And so rather than coming back gradually, Hundley came back in weakened. So these guys were such gamers at the time. It was just a bad confluence of philosophies. The players didn't want to come out of the lineup, and DeRocher did not want to rest them. He had to rest Hundley, and Hundley has gone through the last few decades realizing he played too many games, but at the time, he wanted to win each game. So that team got tired. Fergie set a Cubs record for 42 starts in 1969, and on a couple of occasions pitched on 2 days rest ineffectively. And so these guys, they had to code them. Yeah, if work was offered, you accepted it. And unfortunately, they were going up against a 1970s manager in Gil Hodges of the Mets, who platooned at five different positions to get the most out of a bunch of average players and used two late guys in the bullpen. So it was a 30s manager in DeRocher versus a 70s manager in Hodges. Not a fair fight.
Not a fair fight is right. And so let's talk about going down the stretch of the 69. Cubs, when it was heartbreaking, and the Mets were on that tear, and as you mentioned, the Cubs were playing hurt, they were playing sick, they were playing every game that they possibly could, so they didn't have the same kind of energy that the Mets had, and there's so many other things were happening. Now, I'm assuming that you and Fergie do talk about the Black Cat incident. Is that something that pops up in the book?
Yeah, and again, this is part of the whole mythology of the Cubs, and we at the beginning of the book we talk about the GOAT. The GOAT Cat imprinted, starting in 1969, what that was a publicity stunt by William Sianis, the original owner of the Billy Goats.
Right.
He wanted to publicize his bar, so he tried to buy a ticket for the GOAT in the 1945 World Series. But what was long forgotten is that he brought the GOAT in a hearse to the 1952 Republican Convention. He tried to get the GOAT into Comiskey Park for the 1959 World Series, when Dovek found him out. He ratted him out and tried to bar him. Giannis tried to hire a helicopter to drop him and the GOAT at second base for Game 7, which was never played.
Wow.
So, excuse me, it was a publicity stunt. Mm-hmm. Somehow that got tied to an item of bad luck along with this black cat, which basically was one of the many feral cats that lived under the Shea Stadium stands that feasted on mice. And they had the same thing at Wrigley Field. You had feral cats that lived under the stands of an old creaky ballpark.
Yeah. Yeah, and
so
but
the
again,
bad luck had nothing to do with it. The only bad luck was the bad luck of bad management and bad ownership.
Yeah, that's it. Well, it's an amazing story, and to have it firsthand, to have Fergie write this with you is just really that's really really special. And again, 1969cubs.com for the website and 844-FERGIE-1 if you want to order this book. Let's talk a little bit. Can we talk a little bit about the Chicago Baseball Museum, which is online? Tell us about that and your contributions.
Yeah, well, there had been an effort which right now is kind of in abeyance. To build an actual brick-and-mortar museum. Unable to do that, we've developed a website, and we've dealt with baseball history, Chicago baseball history, including the Negro Leagues. And if you go to chicagobaseballmuseum.org, you can access a microsite on WGN's greatest personality ever, Jack Brickhouse, a man for all seasons. Mm. And so not only do you have Jack's baseball accomplishments, but his other broadcasting feats. And it's a combination of text and audio and video highlights and some great vintage photos, including a nice little telegram from George H.W. Bush to Jack and Pat Brickhouse.
Oh, wow. That's great. Now, tell me, one of the more recent things that you wrote about on that website was Lee Smith and Harold Baines being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and you had interactions with both of those guys. Tell me about that.
Well, I covered Lee Smith when he was with the Cubs. Harold Baines a little bit less with the White Sox. But what people don't realize is they both made their debuts with Chicago teams in the same year in lost seasons. And in the case of Lee Smith, you talk about a 98 loss last place Cubs team in 1980.
Yeah.
Lee Smith was the last of, like, 13 pitchers to pitch on the Cubs that year. 98 losses, they only used 13 pitchers.
Yeah.
In Harold Baines' case, he was a good defensive outfielder, but unfortunately injuries forced him to become a DH. He had a tremendously long and consistent career, and he's back with the Sox as an ambassador right now.
Yeah, and both those guys deserved to be inducted. There's no question about it. Harold Baines and Lee Smith.
I thought Lee Smith got jobbed by the writers both 10-15 years ago. He should have been in a long time ago, but justice was served in this case.
Yeah.
At one time, he had the most saves of anybody in baseball history.
No, there's no question about it. No question about it. He used to make my dad so nervous, though, because he would make it so dramatic. Lee Smith, when they bring Lee Smith in, my dad would get really nervous.
You know why? You know, Lee would sometimes have to face the lineup twice, so if Keith Hernandez came up, Keith might lace a double off of him the second time. And Lee was under pressure by the Dallas Green regime to just keep throwing his fastball, where later in his career he was known for a splitter. He was known for some great breaking pitches. And one time he gave up a game-winning homer to Jack Clark in Wrigley Field on a slider, and the orders came down from the front office, do not throw that pitch again.
Yeah, wow. Interesting stuff. So Lee Smith, Harold Baines, finally they're in the Hall of Fame. He wrote about that. And you can check out the ChicagoBaseballMuseum.org. And also, congratulations on the new book with Fergie Jenkins, the 1969 Cubs, long remembered, never forgotten. You can call 844-FERGIE-1 as well. Real pleasure talking to you, George. We'll get you back on again maybe before baseball season starts, and we'll talk a little more baseball, okay?
You know the way to this house and all these baseball treasures and all these memories that for all these arcane things, Nick, and I'm glad that we shared that Tribune Company orientation about Wrigley Field when it was a very quaint operation.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
Cost as little as a buck to get in there.
That's right. All right, George, it was a pleasure talking to you, and congratulations on the book again. Take care.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Okay, there you go. George Castle, everybody. And the book is called The 1969 Cubs, Long Remembered, Never Forgotten, co-written with Fergie Jenkins, which makes this book different than the other books that have been written about the 69 Cubs because firsthand knowledge, firsthand stories. So, all right. We'll take a quick break for the news here on 720 WG.